This is the State of Things. I'm Anita Rao. Most college grads choose to remember their time on campus with a tint of nostalgia. But when Tracy Dion decided to revisit her time in Chapel Hill, she saw magic. The North Carolina author wove together years of research on the mythology of King Arthur with her real-world experiences on campus. She crafted a young adult fantasy novel called Legendborn. It's a Tar Heel twist on Arthurian legend set under the shadow of Silent Sam and the university's magical secret orders. We follow Bree Matthews, a 16-year-old girl trying to get away from grief in her rural North Carolina home. At a UNC residential program for gifted high school students, she's pulled into a dark world of magic against the backdrop of simmering white supremacy on campus. Author Tracy Dion joins me now. Tracy, welcome to The State of Things.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Of course. So I'd love to start by learning more about the central character, Bree. And I know that you share some in common with her. You lost your own mother at a young age. Bree loses her mother at an even younger age. And in the process of writing this book, you discover that this was sort of a pattern in your family. A lot of people had lost their mothers at a young age and dealt with grief kind of as they were coming into their womanhood. So talk to me a little bit about that and how that informed creating the character.
Sure. Yeah. You know, I think whenever any of us lose someone who's close to us, the natural instinct is to tell the story, is to ask the question, what happened here? And I remember when my mother passed away, having that instinct. I'm a storyteller, you know, a lifelong storyteller and writer. So of course, I immediately went to that space. But when I asked the question and started thinking about her experiences, and knowing that she had lost her mother, I asked, well, what was that like for her at the time? And to have the answer come back that she had lost her own mother within, I think, 2 months of my age, that sparked a different type of curiosity. And I asked my aunt, well, what happened to grandmother? Just asking, is it possible that's a pattern? And finding out that it was. And at this point, you know, I'm a science fiction fantasy author, so I'm creating an answer in my head even before I put pen to paper about what could that possibly be. And asking that question about whose lives and losses get memorialized and get turned into legends, and whose lives and losses become just a mysterious pattern that, you know, we don't have the answer to, sort of sprang up naturally.
And the way that you chose to transform that question into the creation of this whole world that's, you know, a world of magic layered on top of the real world of UNC Chapel Hill, I mean, introduce people who haven't read the book into more of this framework and kind of the setting that Bree is in this world.
Sure. So Bree is at a fictional early college program, something that doesn't exist at UNC. But she comes in a place of grief and curiosity. It's her mother's alma mater. And the thing that I wanted to sort of make known very early on in the novel is create Carolina as its own setting, as its own character, because that was my experience. I went there for 2 degrees, and the history of Carolina, I often tell people you're walking beside history when you're on that campus, because there are so many buildings and statues and memorials and plaques. I mean, even when you go into the Arboretum, you go into look at the plants and see, you know, this cultivar came from this year, what have you. It feels like you're walking amongst really 200 plus years of history, which of course you are. And I wanted to create a sense that Bree could find her own history there, because I think as a student, as a Black student, I was often looking for, like, where is my place here? Because Carolina's history and its memorials do tell a certain type of story about a certain type of figure, and that doesn't always reflect back to the student population that's going there.
Well, yeah, and I mean, you clearly create that kind of, you know, even at the beginning, you allude to, I guess, what would be the parallel to Silent Sam in her world. That statue was still up. That statue is no longer standing. But you see early on kind of the intersection of this, her discovering this world of magic while also really trying to learn her Southern context. So how much did that, I mean, is there a lot of Southern fantasy, and how much did kind of the idea of exploring Southern history while creating this fantasy world shape how you wrote this book?
You know, I have yet to come across a ton of a ton of what I would call sort of like Southern modern day fantasy. I think that you see the South in like Southern Gothic, which is a certain type of subgenre of horror, and you see the South sometimes in, historical genre fiction that takes place, in some specific time or an alternate timeline. But I really wanted to do something that took place today and wrestled with the contemporary issues of today. And so that was something I really hadn't seen. It took a lot of research. I worked with consultants. I even worked with a PhD graduate from the UNC History Department, who focused particularly on, the transatlantic slave trade and the connections to university campuses. And it was sort of perfect. Dr. Hillary Green was a perfect person to work with because she had sort of been living in that space too, and also was a student and had probably walked around with those same sort of questions and concerns.
So as you build this world, both using your experience and your interest in history and kind of excavating the history of the South, but also creating this new world with its new rules of magic, what does that look like? I've always been fascinated how it seems like there are such specific rules. You'd almost have to create a separate book for yourself of reference of this is how the world of magic works that I'm creating.
Yes, as I'm working on book two, I can tell you that I really wish I had just created a wiki at some point for myself. So for me, as a sort of a detail-oriented person, as a former academic and someone who enjoys research, and for the story I needed to tell, the magic that you're talking about needed to be very specific, and it needed to have rules and consequences to get Bree where I needed her to be. And so I think it took a year and maybe a year and a half to come up with the magic system. I think I had about a dozen spreadsheets
Wow.
and three different whiteboards around my house at any given time, one on my office wall, one in my kitchen, so that I could jot something down while things were cooking, because somehow that's a generative time when you're waiting for something to bake or whatever. And then one on my floor that I could walk from room to room and sort of put it down and jot stuff down. But really, my main driver in the development of the magic system was that I really needed to stay in the here and now to tell this story, to talk about the impact of racism and gender issues and sexism, to talk about that really in a way that was challenging contemporary worlds and fantasy worlds. I needed to keep it believable and to create a magic system that could realistically exist for 1500 years and connect back to King Arthur and 6th century Wales required a lot of thinking and a lot of tinkering. And really, a lot of the coolest developments that I came up with for magic came from that drive of, well, what would it have to be in order for it to to be real?
Well, you've got to take us then to King Arthur and Wales and how and why that comes into the picture here.
Yeah, well, it goes back to that first question of whose lives and losses get memorialized. And, we started with the South and UNC. That question is in the air in the South, as I'm sure you know. Whose legacies get put up on a pedestal? But I realized as I was researching that this idea of certain people being legendary, of course, is not very new. And what makes a legend special and not quite exactly the same as a myth is that at the root of every legend, there's a potential person who actually lived and existed, or we collectively, as a community, as a group of humans, believe there's some historical context. We all have believed that person into living. And I remember thinking, well, what do you have to do as a living human being to become legendary? Like, what are the things that, even if we've made up 99% of what this King Arthur figure, who may or may not have existed, is, clearly something was there, some nugget or kernel of amazingness or notoriety or something was enough to grow 1500 years of legends. And so when I started thinking about the fact that I don't have that as a black woman in the South, I can only go back a few generations. That's very common for a lot of black Americans descended from enslaved people. I thought, well, of course I've got someone in my family who must be legendary. I sort of refuse to believe that it's that market is cornered. So once I started working through those tensions, it became natural to go to King Arthur because that is the most persistent legend I think we have, the most widespread legend, and it's one of my favorites as well.
It's really incredible that, you have this deep academic history and rigor to all of this work, but the way that you write it, it feels very accessible, and it feels like the way that the world is kind of built and slowly revealed, like it all makes sense because you learn about this world as the character Bree is learning about this world. So can you talk to me about the choice to to do that, to kind of keep the reader and Bree on the same page in terms of how much they understand at the same time? Because not all fantasy novels work in that way.
It's true. Thank you for saying that, because it was something I really wanted to do and really focused on. I personally, so part of it's a personal preference. I love learning new facts, and I love it when you get to a point in a story where you realize that you understand the impact of some action or decision, but only because you've earned it. Mm. You've earned the knowledge over the course of the book. And so now maybe you and the protagonist have come to the same conclusion at the same time. And that there's something sort of satisfying about engaging with a fictional book like that, where you're like, aha, I wouldn't have known that if I hadn't been through all of the previous chapters of information. So I wanted to have that experience, but I also really wanted to world build Blackness, frankly. I knew traditional publishing is an industry that's not primarily, you know, Black readers, Black editors, Black publishers. And so I knew that white readers would be coming to this, people of other backgrounds and marginalizations would be coming to this story. And because I wanted to write a story that where the protagonist's race could never be removed, like you can't de-race Bree because the entire story falls apart. I knew that I wanted to also sort of invite and also reflect back to Black readers Blackness as an experience. Mm. And so a lot of Bree's first person, we're very intimate in her head, a lot of her first person experiences feel to me very natural and very representative of what it's like to move through a predominantly white institution as a student.
As you went about writing this book and thinking about who was going to be reading it, you mentioned kind of imagining, you know, young Black readers, young white readers. Mm-hmm. You're also writing in this world of where fan fiction is really popular and really exciting, and people love to get invested in the sub storylines and create their own art and writing. As a writer, I've read that you do think about that. You do think about how the engagement of your work may shape kind of what comes next. But can you talk about how that influences the writing process? How do you write in a way that invites people in to kind of create their own spin-off art or curiosity or creations?
I love this. I love this question because I am first and foremost a fangirl. I'm a second generation fangirl. My mother was as well. So I grew up, you know, with the internet as fandom was becoming an internet space. And, you know, fandom obviously existed far beyond that. But once you get into the world of online communities, there's a lot of sharing and a lot of community creation. And what I love is that fans will sort of find the crack in a story and get into it like water and then sort of expand like ice. And there may be a one sentence or one moment that I left open so that if I was a reader and I was really into that character, or I thought this sequence was cool, that I could imagine what happened there. So there are some scenes in the book that are deliberately not on the page, partially because I wanted to keep the momentum and Bree, you know, either Bree wasn't there or she didn't need to be there. But there are also some other sort of ambiguities that I purposefully sort of left. And some of it is my thank you gift, my love letter to fandom. Like, here's an opening. I'm not gonna have that conversation. I want you to have it. I'm excited about what fans might do. So it was a conscious choice. And then I realized too that as a fangirl, as I create fiction, I'm doing it in the way that I enjoy it. And often some of the decisions were subconscious. Like, I didn't realize that I did something and characters have been, writers have been really drawn to this aspect on fanfiction.net or whatever. I think that's a little bit baked into me as a storyteller now, whether or not I want it to be.
I love that. Well, I mean, and you say second generation fangirl because that's kind of paying tribute to your mom and your mom's love for fantasy and her interest in that world. So how do you think she would respond to this book? I mean, what kind of role does she play in it? How do you see her in it, in this world?
Oh, yeah, I've thought about it so much. And, you know, this book is the first huge, gigantic product, you know, in terms of my creative output that I can point to and say it never would have been here if my mother hadn't passed away. And so the irony, of course, is that the tragedy had to happen in order for me to create this thing, and I would never undo Legendborn. And so I feel like I'm more settled even in her loss now because of this book. I think she would love it. I think that she would completely devour it. I think she'd have theories about all of the magic that doesn't get put on the page. And I think she would enjoy all of it. And she'd catch all of my little family Easter eggs and stuff like that. And probably get mad at me about how I treat one character or another and say, like, they didn't deserve that.
Have her own allegiances.
Oh my goodness, yes. Like, big opinions, capital O.
Well, moving forward, are there plans for more novels? Are you continuing to build upon this world that you created with Bree and Legendborn?
Absolutely, yeah. I'm in the middle of book two right now. We sold the trilogy to Brazil. I assume that that will probably move throughout other places, and we'll have the trilogy announced fully elsewhere. But my feeling is that this is launching a universe. I see Legendborn, and particularly, as you mentioned, the sort of expansive magic system. You know, we could go forwards and backwards. We could look at other characters' histories. We could look at Bree's mother's history. I think there's a lot of room to wiggle around there.
North Carolina author Tracy Dion's new book is Legendborn. Tracy, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you. This is wonderful.
North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Anita Rao.